this is Johnny Walker, and you're listening to An American Life, The Bruce Springsteen Story. Over the next 3 weeks here on Radio 2, we're going to be hearing from the man himself, the boss, on his life and music. Bruce Springsteen has spoken exclusively and at length to create a unique and in-depth portrait. This three-part series also features contributions from those closest to Springsteen and his many admirers in the music world who give us their insight into his appeal, his achievements, and his legacy.
He's a great storyteller. I think his songs are real and they're very cinematic. They're very slice of life.
I think Bruce Springsteen is kind of the poet laureate of American music, really. He very much said, I am of the American urban experience.
It was the fundamental way that I connected myself to the world. It's still a tremendous source of inspiration for me.
It was a very slow climb up. We really built our audience one person at a time.
It was a shock to me that there were 23,000 people who I did not know who had gone out and got the music.
He's totally, utterly non-J-Lo, I'm very pleased to say. He's one of those people who walks it like he talks it.
You strip away the specifics of New Jersey. What he's talking about is trying to fashion something meaningful out of being a working class guy.
Everyone has memories that they live within you. They are an essential part of who you are and that reveal to you what it meant to be alive. That's the writer's job. The writer collects and creates those moments.
In 1974, the rock critic and future Springsteen manager John Landau wrote, I've seen rock and roll future, and its name is Bruce Springsteen.
The screen door slams, Mary's dress waves. Like a vision, she dances across the porch as the radio plays.
For once, outrageous hype would be borne out by the events that followed. The next year, Springsteen released his third album, Born to Run, and immediately established himself as one of the pivotal figures in American music. His romanticism has never blinded him to the darker side of life, and the mixture has captivated rock fans the world over for more than a quarter of a century.
The music gets in and messes with your spirit and messes with the deepest parts of you, and also it gets a hold of you physically, you know, which is pretty unusual. There's not that many things that do that. When people come to the show, and it's been part of rock and roll since the Bill Haley concert where the guy stood up and, you know, threw the first chair across the room or something, you know, it's just a part of like, I'm out of here, you know, meaning I'm out of myself. I'm, you know, you're sort of, it's like the jail door of you swings open for a few minutes and you get out. And I think that that experience is something that people seek at rock and roll shows and elsewhere, you know. We play with that idea a lot on stage, and we half joke with it, and we're half sort of serious about it, so.
But the Bruce Springsteen story really starts in the small New Jersey town of Freehold.
Dirty old street aisle, slushed up in the rain and snow.
The place where he first saw Elvis on TV, and as this song, The Wish, tells, where he persuaded his mother to buy him a guitar.
Little boy and his mind shivering outside, run down music store window.
Springsteen was born in September 1949, the son of a factory worker and a secretary, and all the signs were that he would follow his parents and his peers into a similar life, decent but undistinguished. That guitar, however, opened a door into another very different world.
The minute I began to sing and I went down to the Elks Club, and I picked up my guitar. I remember I sang Twist and Shout. I felt different, you know, very different.
On stage with Bruce that night in 1965 were the Castiles, a band he joined after their leader, George Theis, came round to date his older sister. They were also the recipients of Springsteen's first ever song, Baby I. Reputedly written in the car on the way to the recording session in 1966.
It was a remarkable time, looking back. I don't think it's happened before or since.
Stephen Van Zandt, the man now known to millions as Silvio Dante from TV series The Sopranos, also known as Little Stephen.
We had our own venues. There was high schools he played. There was beach clubs. There was the TV show called Hullabaloo had clubs. There was a teenage nightclub called a Teen Devu. There was VFW halls, union halls. Just dozens and dozens and dozens of places to play as a teenage rock and roll band, which I'm sure don't exist anymore. So we were very lucky to be in that generation.
Like most teenage bands, the Castiles didn't last long, and the young Bruce found himself rattling through a series of other groups, most notably Steel Mill, where he played hard and heavy rock music, like this track, The Wind and the Rain. The classic local band, huge at home, unknown everywhere else. Steel Mill eventually foundered after an unsuccessful trip to the West Coast. And at the age of 19, Springsteen found himself back where he started from, 15 miles east of Freehold, in the resort of Asbury Park.
The one thing that was unique about the town at the time was there was a club that was open from 8 to 5 in the morning where there wasn't any booze served, and it was just kids, you know. And because it was open 2 or 3 hours after the bars closed, all musicians, after they finished their regular gigs at the bars, they would come down and everybody would play.
The wind and rain slashing at my window pane. Lightning's flashing, looks like the sky's gone insane. And it seems like you have lied again. And now I'm left with the wind and the rain.
It was late 60s, a place called the Upstage, and it was a tremendous meeting place for both local musicians and musicians who simply came into the area to work over the course of the summer. It was really a shock. I can remember walking in and I felt like I'd really discovered something. It was an amazing place simply to exist. Basically, it was how I began to play with many of the fellas that I'd play with for a long, long part of my career.
One of those fellows was Stephen Van Zandt.
I was on the Jersey Shore, a place called Middletown, which is about, 20 minutes from the ocean. Then there's a triangle down south to Asbury Park, which was about 30 miles or so. And then another 20 miles west to Freehold, where Bruce was from. And then back up north to where we were. So there's a sort of a triangle there, which made up what they call the Jersey Shore.
Gary Tallon.
He was playing at a place called the Upstage Club, and the dance floor was packed, and I turned my chair around to check this new guy out, and I thought he was great. And at that point, the dance floor cleared, so it was just kind of me sitting there looking at him, and he saw me, and he thought I was, like, giving him a bad vibe or something. So his first impression of me was he didn't like me. Who's this guy?
There was maybe 10 bands or so, 10 or 12 bands that popped up as part of the post-British invasion thing, where February 8th, 1964, there was nobody in a band, and February 10th, everyone was in a band, because on February 9th, the Beatles played Ed Sullivan.
Groups like Dr. Zoom and the Sonic Boom and the rather more prosaic Bruce Springsteen Band laid the foundations of the future E Street Band. But although their mix of rock, R&B and soul music was hugely popular on the Jersey Shore, Bruce had something else in mind.
I began to write music that would not have worked in a club. It required too much attention and too much listening and a certain kind of focus. Bars were for something else, you know. But I felt like if I was going to take a real shot at it, I was going to have to do something that was going to be very distinctive and original. And I think I wanted the independence, I wanted the individuality of the solo career. And I just sat in my room and I just began to write. That's when I began to write some of the initial songs, probably for Greetings from Asbury Park. And I was living in Asbury, above this little beauty salon, and it was out of business, and I had an old piano in the back of it. And at night I'd go down and sit with the hair dryer, amidst all the hair dryers. And I wrote a bunch of the songs from that album around that time, in a way that I hadn't before. And it was the only thing that I was doing. I wasn't working in the bars at the time. I was strictly working on my writing and hoping that I was going to get somewhere, find somebody who was interested in it.
That person turned out to be John Hammond at Columbia Records, the man who discovered Bob Dylan and Billie Holiday.
Bruce Springsteen, Columbia Pop Audition, job number 79682, Mary Queen of Arkansas, take one.
Bruce had a new manager, the energetic and passionately committed Mike Appel, who hustled a meeting with the legendary record man.
Mary Queen of Arkansas, it's not too early for dreaming.
It was exciting to be there with him. I knew a lot about him and the work that he'd done and the people he'd discovered and his importance that he'd played in music, and it was very exciting to just feel like you were worth his time. That was something that meant a lot to me, I think. No matter what had happened, feeling that even if it was just for this particular night. He was very encouraging, you know, but you never know until you know what's going to happen. But to just simply have been there in that room with him at the board was one of my greatest recording experiences.
Mary, my queen, your blows for freedom are the same.
It was old-fashioned, sort of. I mean, everybody was in ties and shirts, you know. And you hit the button, and off you go, you know. And I was excited. I felt I'd written some good songs, and I felt that this was my shot. I had nothing to lose, and I felt like I was like the beginning of something. I was hoping it was the beginning of something, not the end, I guess.
Hey, bus driver, keep the change. Bless your children, give them names. Don't trust men who walk with canes. Drink this, and in a week you'll have wings on your feet. Broadway Mary Joan Fontaine, advertiser on a downtown train. Oh, Christmas crier, busted cane.
Does this bus stop at 82nd Street from Bruce Springsteen's 1972 debut album for Columbia, Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey? But John Hammond had seen only one version of what Bruce Springsteen could be. Bruce had other plans.
I wanted a band at that time because I'd played with a group for a long time, and I knew that a big part of my abilities were when it came time to present what I was doing was going to be able to use a band to do that.
Well, I stood stone like at midnight, suspended in my masquerade, and I combed my hair till it was just right, and commanded the night brigade. I was hoping to paint and cross.
Here's little Stephen.
I fully consciously intended to make Bruce Springsteen the biggest star in the world if I could. I felt he deserved it. I felt he was unique, something that the industry needed and that the history of rock and roll needed. Someone who had a sense of tradition. That wasn't really the way people were thinking at that point. It was glam and disco and theatricality and that really David Bowie had introduced. And I felt Bruce was very much not that.
Flag of piracy flew from my mast. My sails were set wing to wing.
I handed the record in, it was finished. And Clive Davis sent it back, says there's no singles. You know, it's all singles. So I'm in the music business now, you know. So, but I said, well, okay, you know, I'll write some.
She was blinded by the light. Oh, cut loose like a deuce, another brother in the night.
Yeah, it was an odd moment there because he ended up getting signed as a solo artist, which was a bit weird for me. You know, I didn't really relate to solo artists. I still really don't. There were bands over here and solo artists over there, and then end up Bruce Springsteen and E Street Band somewhere in the middle, you know. So he found a way to sort of be the best of both worlds. But at the time, there was no both worlds. you were a band or you were a singer-songwriter, solo artist coming from the folk world, which is how he got signed, which was an odd thing for me and those of us who knew him, because we were the two or three of the big local rock and roll guys, guitar players. We were the Jeff Becks and Jimmy Pages or wannabes, you know. So for him to be signed as a solo folk artist was just a bit strange, and first record reflected that sort of bizarre combination of things.
Crazy Janie and a Mission Man were back in the alley trading hands. Long came Wild Billy with his friend G-Man, all rooted up for Saturday night. Well, Billy slammed on his coast of briefs and said anybody would want to go on up to Greasy Lake. It's about a mile down on the dark side of Route 88. I got a bottle of rose, but let's try it. We'll pick up Hazy Davy and Killer Joe, and I'll take you all out to where the gypsy angels go. They feel like life. Ooh, let's dance like spirits all the night.
All the night.
Yeah, all the night.
All the night.
Oh, you don't know what they can do to you.
Another crucial component of the burgeoning E Street Band was saxophonist Clarence Clemons.
Went back home and I remember it might have been the fall or something. I sat on the beach and I think I wrote Spirit in the Night, Blinded by the Light. I moved back a little bit into the R&B that I'd been working on earlier, and so I said, hey, you know, I'm going to try and find that sax player. I'd met him while I was playing in Asbury, and he was hard to find, which wasn't that uncommon in those days. You'd see people, and then you wouldn't see them, and you couldn't find them. They didn't have any place they were living. I didn't have any place I was living. You know, there was no one had addresses, and so you had to, sometimes months would go by before you saw that person and was able to catch them again, and that's sort of what happened to him. And I got a hold of him, and he came in and played on those two songs from that record, so that's how we sort of filled the band out at that time.
Well, now Hazy Davy got really hurt. He ran into the lake in just his socks and a shirt. Me and Crazy Janie was making love in the dirt, singing our birthday songs. Janie said it was time to go, so we closed our eyes and said goodbye to Gypsy Angel Row. Felt so right. Together we move like spirits in the night.
All night.
In the night.
All night.
Oh, you don't know what they can do to you. Felt spirits in the night.
This is Johnny Walker, and you're listening to An American Life, the Bruce Springsteen Story on BBC Radio 2. Singer and songwriter Thea Gilmore.
I think Bruce Springsteen is an awesome lyricist, but his songs aren't sort of clever or particularly cerebral, but they hit you at an instinctive level, I think. After you listen to a Bruce Springsteen song, you're left feeling like the song has kind of always been there. It's not like you've just heard it, it's like you've heard it 1,000 times before. It's an amazing thing for a writer to do. It's a very difficult thing for a writer to do, to paint such a massive canvas with such, if I say simple, I don't mean simplistic, I just mean sort of simple language that appeals to everybody.
By the time of his second album, released in 1973 as The Wild, The Innocent and The E Street Shuffle, Springsteen had refined his tales of New Jersey nightlife to create a compelling portrait of a world which, although fictionalized and romanticized, was still one that his listeners knew. The musicians adding their own distinctive touches, not least accordion player Danny Federici.
The band at that time, we were folk musicians. I think with the exception of Danny, who'd taken a lot of accordion lessons, there wasn't any real formal training, you know. And people played very, very personally and very eccentrically. And if you listen to those cuts from The Wild and The Innocent, the first record also, and the cuts from that period of time, the band is playing very unusual. It's a little Carney band, you know. You hear the influences, which really Danny had a lot to do with, was the boardwalk, the accordion, and then just the atmosphere from the lyric writing which came out of that particular environment.
Sandy, the fireworks are hailing over Little Eden tonight. Forcing a light and all those stony faces left stranded on this warm July. Down in time, the circuits fall a switch. Blade lovers, so fast, so shiny, so sharp. As the wizards play down on Pinball Way, on the boardwalk way past dark.
Danny Federici.
We did a lot of acoustic stuff in the early days. A lot of radio shows where we couldn't take anything but the accordion. So it was kind of a natural thing. I guess I'm a very feeling player. I can really read a lot. And plus, when you're together with someone for such a long time, you really can feel their energy and you know which way to play.
But live, Bruce and the newly christened E Street Band, named after the address of their rehearsal space, were a completely different proposition. They played incessantly through 1973 and 74, and everywhere they went, the story was the same. Now a major figure at the MTV networks, Bill Flanagan was just one of thousands who came away convinced that he, like John Lando, had seen rock and roll future.
Spread out now, Rosie, Dr. Comfort, looser mama's rain. You know playing blind man's love is a little baby's game.
In about 1973 and 74, I was in Providence, a school just outside of Boston, and there was a tremendous amount of talk about this guy who was playing the bar as Bruce Springsteen, and yet I couldn't get a fix on what he was, because somebody would say, it's like the Jay Giles band, and somebody else would say, oh, he's like John Prine. So I thought, is he a folky? Is he a blues guy? What is it? And I finally went to see him play for $2 at midnight in a college classroom at my school. And kind of, if I hadn't spent $2 on the ticket, probably wouldn't have gone back. So remember, I was out with my friends. I said, oh, I should go do this. And I said to people, and people thought I was crazy, holy smoke, this is like seeing Elvis Presley before he got signed to RCA. This is like seeing the Beatles at the Cavern Club. I was shaking people going, do you see what we're seeing here? Can you believe it?
He had the songs, he had the band, he had the reputation. All Bruce Springsteen needed now was the record that was going to pull it all together.
In the day we sweated out on the streets of a runaway American dream. At night
going to run for the first time, I went in to specifically use the studio as a tool and to use it in a way that was unnatural, that was not an attempt to replicate the sound when we played. Both writing it was very difficult, and then recording it and getting a sound that I felt approximated the sound that I wanted was very difficult, and the records began to take a long time. I was striving for something very specific that I didn't know how to get, so I had to spend time in search of it, finding it.
But find it he did. Born to Run was an instant classic, co-produced by John Landau and sounding, in a memorable phrase of the time, like a 1963 Cadillac running on Melted Down Crystals records. Badly Drawn Boys' Damon Goff.
He's always touched on the relationship and the breaking free and finding your feet in life and winning against all the odds and carving a path for yourself, making this crappy old world something good. And that's always been what he's good at. Thunder Road just became the song that represented the moment where I discovered Bruce and discovered music in a different way than I had before that. Bruce came along and it was just different to anything else. It was probably the initial spark of me doing it now, but it wasn't until I was 21, 22 that I even thought about being a singer. Didn't appeal to me, but it must have been some kind of spark going back to 15, 14 year old. So being a loyal person, Thunder Road just became the one that meant something.
Bill Flanagan watched Bruce's momentum build.
With a kill of graces and the secret places that no more can fill.
Born to Run, the album, certainly brought Bruce to a wider public. There was a real slow build going on. His live shows had been sort of town by town, grabbing people by the neck and winning converts, and he was moving like John the Baptist through the desert, just building a bigger and bigger audience. In the early summer of 75, a few months before Born to Run came out, his first two albums appeared on the charts for the first time, and week by week were moving up, 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 so that when Born to Run hit, there was a kind of a boiling over waiting to happen, and that album went to number 3, and of course he was on the cover of Time and Newsweek the same week, which was unprecedented, especially in those days. Only the president had a shot at being on those two influential magazines the same week. So suddenly he was famous overnight.
Little Stephen.
At that point, we had a substantial following. We probably could have done a million records worldwide without any radio at that point, which was quite an achievement. At that point, you can make a living. You're in that very, very unique middle, what I call the middle, of which there's virtually doesn't exist. You know, you're either nowhere or you're a success.
The thing he had been building through his live shows was working really, really well, and he would have gotten there anyway. And then he had to contend with a certain amount of suspicion that he was a hype, that he was a media creation, that he was a rock critic's creation.
We actually had such a good reputation live that we could make a living and not only break even, make a few dollars, although we had not very much airplay, and then managed to have that first hit single, and damn, we went from 1 million to 3 million just like that, playing arenas everywhere. And once you're selling out arenas, you very much made it. You're there.
The original E Street Band, the one that made the Wild, the Innocent, and the E Street Shuffle, it was a very kind of jazzy group, half black and half white, that was able to bring in bits of sort of the band and Van Morrison and Dylan and Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry and soul music and put it together in a way that didn't sound like a hodgepodge. It sounded very, very unified, very, very strong. The version of the E Street Band that appeared at the time of Born to Run, where Steve Van Zandt, Max Weinberg, and Roy Bittan came in, was sort of more focused. It was much more, and this is of course also where John Landau came in. We're a rock and roll band, and we're going to make rock and roll music. And we're not going to go off so much into the jazz side or into the folky side. It's going to be right down the middle, but it's going to be the biggest, grandest rock and roll anybody ever made.
As Bruce's profile rose at home, so the pressure for him to expand his audience outside the US increased. Accompanied by former Beatle aide Tony Bramwell, Springsteen and the E Street Band undertook a short tour of Europe, culminating in, to Bruce's mind at least, a disastrous UK show at London's Hammersmith Odeon. It's not a fond memory for little Stephen either.
God, you know, the first time you travel, it's a shock. I don't know why, at that age, you're trying to relate things to what you know. I guess, you know, you need to find some familiar ground to walk on, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you're going somewhere else, so you would think you'll enjoy the difference. But that's not what happens the first time you travel. I remember us just desperately searching for a hamburger. There was no McDonald's.
Tony Bramwell.
They did the sound check, and after the sound check, Bruce went and wandered around the front of the theatre and saw all these hideous posters, sort of, "Is London ready for Bruce Springsteen?" Really got up his nose. And there was a lack of communication between the whole band and CBS Records at the time. Bruce ripped all the posters down, he just went mad climbing up the scaffolding, tearing them away, and he badly cut his hand on paper cuts or on the staples that were holding the displays up. But he did the show, and it was brilliant, a wonderful show, but of course the London audience just sat there, sort of, show us what you can do. They just could not get the atmosphere going that we had in the States. And after the show, there was a party which CBS had, and we all went to it, and after a few minutes, he just said, "I can't take this, can I go and stay in your house?" So we all piled into the limousines and went back to my house, and sat up all night watching videos of James Dean, and probably the people at CBS one who weren't at the artist had gone to.
And things were no easier for Springsteen when he got back home. A lawsuit launched after Bruce's decision to change managers from Appel to Landau meant he was prevented from recording for nearly 2 years. When he returned to the studio to make Darkness at the Edge of Town, the relief was palpable.
Darkness, the stakes had changed. They had gotten a lot higher. All of a sudden, I had an audience. Hadn't really had one. Had a small little grassroots audience. The first record sold about 20,000. I remember I asked him, I said, "Mike, he says, how many we sell?" I said, "About 23,000. And he was disappointed. I said, "We did?" I said, "Who are all those people buying the records out there?" It was a shock to me that there were 23,000 people who I did not know who had gone out and got the music that we made. I felt it was a great success, you know.
Hey, man, you got
then when the third record hit, all of a sudden we had an audience that people took notice of, that the record company took notice of. It was the beginning of a real relationship going. So all of a sudden you're being observed and watched a lot more closely than you had been previously. All of a sudden your actions have implications. It was a very, very different moment in my work life. And I thought differently about everything. I began to think about who I was, where I came from. It was a disorienting moment, but it's also one of those moments when you either find yourself on your feet or you get blown over by sort of what's happened to you and you get lost and maybe you don't find your way back. And that happens to a lot of people.
I've been working real hard trying to get my hands clean. We'll drive that dusty road from underway.
Stuart McConey.
I quite like Dancing Ninja 10 in general because it's a very underrated record, because he has this habit of following up a huge record with quite a muted record. So quite a strange record, quite somber.
Things that Bruce wrote about, not least on Badlands and Prove It All Night, took a fundamental turn as well. Up to now, his best songs had been about escape, about running away from a repressive community. But once the lovers from Born to Run stopped sprinting, where did they end up?
Those were the questions that sort of came up for me at that particular time. Was initially you're in search of a certain sort of freedom, you know, you want some sense of control of the arc that your life is going to take. You know, grew up in a particular environment where those things were very circumscribed, you know. You had a very particular sort of place you were going to fit into, and so your initial thrust is to explode those limits for yourself.
I got a 69 Chevy with a 396 Fuley heads and a Hurst on the floor. She's waiting tonight down in the parking outside the 7-Eleven store. Me and my partner, Sonny, built her straight out of scratch, and he rides with me from town to town. We only run for the money, got no strings attached. We shut him up and then we shut him down. Strips just right. I wanna blow 'em off in my first heat. Summer's here and the time is right for racing in the street.
Billy Bragg.
Well, I think when he stopped shouting and started getting serious about things, there's an incredible moment in Darkness on the Edge of Town when it comes to track 5. Where he's kind of like, before that, he's kind of still kind of like, you know, shouty Bruce Springsteen doing big things. And all of a sudden, you come to Racing in the Street. And here's a song ostensibly about cars and girls. But the whole way he's singing it, it's almost as if he's taking one of his huge, great big songs that everyone's familiar with, and he's doing it as a contrast to its usual arrangement, as he often does. But with Racing in the Street, it actually is a really, really sad, inward-looking song, and I think that's the first real moment that it struck me that there's something more going on here than just Born to Run, which is a great song, and I admired his songwriting before then. But I think the thing for me about Racing in the Street is that it's the first song where you really start to get a message from Bruce that he understands that there's something deeply sad underneath the American dream, that it's actually quite hollow. He kind of builds on that subsequently, particularly on the river, you know, the famous punchline is a dream of life, it doesn't come true.
Little Steven.
I mean, we didn't know how to make records for quite a while. It took quite a while before that caught up. Didn't really equal out to The River, which was the fifth album. The record started to feel like what would happen live.
Springsteen's answer to the dilemma of success was to produce his most ambitious record to date. In 1980, he released the double album The River, an album full of hits, but also of dark and brooding meditations on family relationships.
Well, Papa, go to bed now, it's getting late. Nothing we can say is gonna change anything now. I'll be leaving in the morning from St. Mary's Gate. We wouldn't change this thing even if we could somehow. Cause the darkness of this house has got the best of us. There's a darkness in this town that's got us too. But they can't touch me now, and you can't touch me now. They ain't gonna do to me what I watch them do to you. So say goodbye, it's Independence Day. It's Independence Day all down the line.
Just Independence Day. The river was, Bruce remembers, a key moment.
By the time we got into the river, I felt adulthood was on the horizon, if it had not yet arrived, you know? And so I knew that I was going to be following my characters over a long period of time. And I thought it would be fun. It was what I was interested in doing, and I thought it would be interesting and fun for my audience to have a certain sort of continuity. Not real explicit or overly literal or confined, but just a loose continuity from record to record that allowed people to know who you were and where you were going and what you were trying to do.
I come from down in the valley where Mr. when you're young, they bring you up to do like your daddy done. Me and Mary, we met in high school and she was just 17. We drive out of this valley down to where the fields were green. We go down to the river, and into the river we dive. Oh, down to the river we ride.
But the river might have been a very different record if Bruce had followed his instincts more exactly. A growing interest in and engagement with politics in its broadest sense had begun to surface in his life and his music. It began with an appearance at the No Nukes concert of the same year and the recording of Roulette, a song written about the Three Mile Island nuclear accident.
It was the first song we cut for that record, and maybe I thought it was too specific later on, that it wasn't general enough, and in the end, the story I'd started to move to tell was a little more of a general one on the river. It went a little over the top, which is what's good about it. It got left off. In truth, it should have probably gotten put on. You know, it would have been one of the best things on the record, and it was just a mistake at the time. You get very oversensitive when you're going to release the thing.
Left the toys out in the yard. I took my wife and kids and I left my home unguarded.
The river kept Bruce's career on an upward path and brought him back to Europe.
I gotten my nerve up and went back.
But this time, the experience was a very different one.
At that particular point, America was really, it was the early 80s, and the sense of violence was in the air on a daily basis. Sometimes I was 30, having kids was on the horizon in some fashion. And just sort of the way things were put to you, you know, either whether it was through television or through different, it was just much more aggressive and abusive truly abusive. I experienced less of that in Europe, just less of it. The other thing was we really connected with the European audience at that time.
Little Stephen.
I started to feel that this rock and roll thing was remarkable. When you hear people in a different country singing your lyrics back to you, even though they don't speak the language, I felt this is really some sort of universal communication that we don't use often enough.
Well, I rode that ribbon highway. I saw above me the endless skyway. I saw below me the golden valley. Well, this land was made for you and me. Well, this land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest, to the Gulf Stream waters. Well, this land was made for you and me. Now the sun came shining.
Starting a pattern that would sustain him for much of his later career, Springsteen's response to the worldwide success of The River was to take a step back from the circus and change direction. Not even he was ready for what came next, though, a literal solo album, recorded on cassette and containing some of the most powerful songs of his career.
Well, the entire record of Nebraska, I had no intention of really recording in that fashion whatsoever. It was a mistake, you know. It was an accident, let's say, you know.
Bill Flanagan.
I think Nebraska was an incredibly important record for Springsteen, and I think you could make a case that it was even his best record.
There's a place out on the edge of town, sir, rising above the factories and the fields. Ever since I was a child, I can remember that mansion on the hill. In the day you can see the children playing on the road that leads those gates of heart and steel. Steel gates that completely surround the mansion on the hill.
I think I'd read it in a review someplace that someone mentioned the record had a variety of political implications, and at the time, that was my most personal record. It was a record that felt most like my childhood, you know. It was a record that reminded me of the way my childhood felt. Just in the tone of it, the colors that it had on it, just the house that I grew up in. And so for me, I think I was sort of digging into that in a certain way. I don't know how those stories particularly evolved. They were things I'd gotten interested in.
There was nothing more unexpected in 1982, sort of the height of New Wave, and at the time of the greatest disrepute of folkies. Springsteen came out with an acoustic album made on a cassette in his bedroom.
Nebraska is a favorite album of many musicians and fans, not least Jesse Malin.
Johnny's waving I was into punk rock. My dad gave me Nebraska, which was done on a four-track. It's just him and an acoustic guitar. And I was like, man, this guy's a millionaire, a billionaire, and he seems real. There's just something really true about this record, and stark and honest and really dark. And so it got me thinking really different. I started reading the lyrics, and I went back and realized that everything I thought he was glorifying, you know, even with Born in the USA and all that, that it was really about getting out of that. It was the opposite. It was about getting out of New Jersey or this small mainstream kind of town.
And I think it was an incredibly important step. It was very well received, first of all. People loved it, which was in itself kind of a triumph. For a record like that, it sold shockingly well, which showed that his audience was willing to make turns with him and follow him into unexpected places.
The stark landscapes of the Nebraska album, you can almost hear the wind blowing all the way from Nebraska down to the Texas Panhandle through that album.
I think that it often happens that a band gets to a certain commercial point and a certain musical point where you can tell that the next step can make them into household names, can bring it to everybody, can conquer top 40 radio. And the very brave and ambitious artists don't immediately take that next step. They do something to sort of solidify the relationship with the audience. So everyone was waiting now for what Born in the USA became, for the big record that was going to sell zillions and give him a string of hit singles. And Springsteen chose that moment to kind of pause, pull back, and say to his audience, let's make sure we really know each other before we go on that trip, and let's make sure that you're in this for as much as I am. And it takes a lot of courage.
I'd reached a point where I was old enough now to realize what was missing. And so I felt like I was teetering on this sort of void very often. And I felt a deep, deep sense of isolation and very difficult to get in. And it became very, very intense around that time. And I think that led me to those characters and to those kinds of stories. Because I just felt like that, you know, for my own reasons, you know. When you get older, the price for not sorting through the issues that make up your emotional life and the choices you're making doesn't stay the same. It gets higher all the time. And at that point, I felt like I was at a place where I could start to really feel that price, you know. At the same time I recorded Nebraska, I was recording Born in the USA in the studio in New York, so I had these two extremely different recording experiences going. I was in my house with a little tape player about, you know, three or four times the size of this book with a couple of microphones and these songs that I'd written that I wasn't sure where they came from. And then I was going to the city and cutting this big sort of studio album, you know. They happened simultaneously. There was a period where I was going to put them out as a double record. They were both going to come out at the same time. I didn't know what to do with it. Born down in a dead man's town. The first kick that took us when I hit the ground. End up like a dog that's been beat too much. Till you spend half your life just covering up now. Born in the USA. I was born in the USA. I was born in the USA. Born in the USA. Now, got in a little hometown jam. So they pulled her out the wind in my hands. Sent me off to a foreign land. To go and kill the yellow man. Born in the USA. Born in the USA. Born in the USA. Born in the USA. Come back home to
the... It was this our time. You know, it was like the Born in the USA thing coinciding with the whole American thing and Reagan thing and, I don't know, misinterpretations or whatever came into play at that point, and it just all sort of worked, you know, intentionally or unintentionally. It was a remarkable success, way beyond what you would even dream of.
Next time, we'll look at how Bruce Springsteen used his conflicting creative impulses to surprise and wrongfoot both fans and critics to enter the most successful phase of his career to date. An American Life, the Bruce Springsteen story, was produced for BBC Radio 2 by Unique, the production company.
This is Hubert Gregg, seated once again in the Friday night square chair.